I hear Trey say, and that's where we're headed. But I think the thing that really stands out to me is that we have no idea where we're headed. Anybody that tells you they know what's coming is just making their best guess. And that's a real answer, even though it's hard to accept. Golic and Wingo on ESPN Radio, ESPN News, presented by Progressive Insurance. All of our guests are on the Shell Penzo Performance Line. Jason Fitz in for Trey Wingo, Mike Golic, sitting with Mike Golic Jr. And the thing that keeps haunting me, Mike, as we look at the return of sports, is the lack of conversation that involves the phrase, not sure. Mike could, maybe, like I'll use all my Southernisms, right? Like, could be. I mean, that's the real answer. Everybody wants definitive answers on what's going to happen with the return of sports. But the reality of it is nobody has any idea. And when you start looking at how we're getting closer and closer to the return and players are getting more uncomfortable, I don't blame them because there aren't real answers that tell us anything. One positive COVID-19 test shut down the sports world months ago. And now we're in a world where we're like, oh, I mean, 30 LSU players have it. Hey, we're fine. Like, nobody knows.
We knew a lot less then than we did now, though. And I think we need to acknowledge that in all of this. And I think what you're saying and what players are looking for are two different things. We can't predict what the virus is going to do. We can't, unfortunately, get larger society to buy into the reality of this situation. But what the leagues can control and what the players are looking for are the guidelines that we're going to follow, the testing protocol that we're going to use and all this, and the rules and regulations surrounding it. We just talked to Buster Olney, who has been as down on Major League Baseball's prospect going forward as anyone in all this, because he knows and he sees everything that's going on. And he, when he was surprised and hearing from people around Major League Baseball who were surprised at how ironclad and well the protocols in the return for baseball players to their facilities went, those are the things, the control that NFL players, I'm sure, are looking at the league and saying, we need to get these figured out so we can get any degree of comfort with this.
Part of the strangeness of it, though, is there's a sense around the NFL players, at least from what we've heard. And again, there was one report recently that Philip Rivers asked on a conference call, what happens if there's a test and I test positive for COVID-19, but I'm asymptomatic right before the Super Bowl? Do I have to sit it out? The answer is yes. It feels like players are looking at it saying, well, what's going to keep me off the field? Because they need to know that. But it's partially like the mentality of all of this. Like, we have to come into it, I understand, with the mentality of how do we get back? What do we do? What's the safest way? But I think the key word is safest, not safe. Because at this point, there is no real answer that says, hey, you're not putting yourself at risk. So how do we mitigate those risks? Or how do we make sure that the testing is such that the players are in the best situation possible? I just fear what we've already seen from MLS. And it's like we're just ignoring the fact that the first game back from MLS was supposed to be Nashville versus Dallas for the MLS back tournament. And it didn't get postponed. It got canceled. It's gone. Like, it's gone because they had so many positive tests on those teams. What are we going to do when the inevitable happens here, which is all of a sudden we wake up, I wake up as a Raiders fan and I find out that, 12 Chiefs have tested positive for COVID-19. Like, did they just forfeit the game and I get the win? Like, these are the weird things that we have no idea how to answer.
We're going to see those things happen. Like, prepare yourselves. A team is probably going to have to forfeit. It's going to happen if we have college football, and I'd imagine it's going to happen if we have NFL football. I'm trying to prepare myself for that reality right now, because the other thing that happened with the MLS is back then, it started last night. And once you removed FC Dallas from the equation, Taylor Twellman came on with us and said, you were dealing with an almost drop to, I believe it was almost zero, if not completely zero, once you removed those two teams from the equation and all this. And so it's, how do you adjust in all these things? And you can't adjust. You can't start fixing the shutters or redo the roof on your house until you make sure you've got a foundation and the framework in place. And that's what the NFL is searching for right now. They're going to have to pull some of the players back from themselves, because what you heard from Philip Rivers and what you're going to hear from others is the same mentality they take to every other injury or physical ailment for players. How soon can I get back, and what are you going to do to keep me off the field? And you know what we've done since then? We've adjusted. When it comes to the concussion protocol, we take helmets literally away from players in this. And you're going to have to treat that largely the same, because like we started to understand with concussions and other injuries, there's a severity of this that we didn't recognize before, and now we've got to treat it with extreme caution. There's a severity to a virus that we don't yet have a vaccine for that we've recognized we have to treat with extreme caution. And so J.C. Treader and the others in the Players Association, who have health and safety in the forefront, whether it comes to injuries or this virus, are going to go out there and have to argue on behalf of the players with the cooperation of the league in a way that keeps all that at the forefront. In some instances, as we've seen with other players going to work out, in spite of what a lot of players maybe want to do in this regard, because that's the way that they've always operated.
But you mentioned foundation. And the hardest part about foundation to me is that MLS, NBA, they can build foundation because they're building a house in one location. How do you build the foundation for a house that can stay safe when you're not doing that? Because one thing that has to be noted for Nashville and Dallas that had so many positive coronavirus tests for MLS, they live in two areas that aren't handling the virus the same as some of the rest of the country is. Well, we have teams in Dallas. And I mean, when you talk about the NFL, you're talking about the Cowboys and the Titans, and they're going to be living in, they're not going to be in a bubble. So I struggle to see the foundation. Now, I think to that end, you mentioned J.C. Treader. He was on with Golic and Wingo yesterday and talked about not just the issue of getting back, but the more important issue of getting through a season.
Our focus has to be on not just getting back. Anybody can get back. It's about staying back. And it's about finishing a season and not finding ourselves in a position that we get back there and then we get shut down midway through or early on. That's kind of worst case scenario for everybody. So I think every decision we make needs to be about mitigating as much risk as possible and avoiding that worst case scenario. And we know we'll never be able to get rid of all risk, but every decision that we don't make to mitigate as much risk as possible is going to cost us.
Mitigating risk is the most difficult part of this. And look, I've said this to some radio stations I've hung out with us over the course of the last week. We have so much COVID-19 conversation. Like, I really don't give a damn what anybody thinks about wearing a mask at this point. I personally think everybody should wear a mask. I don't care what anybody thinks about it. There's an actuality that we have to deal with at this point, which is the virus is spreading. And it doesn't matter why the virus is spreading. It doesn't matter how the virus is spreading. It doesn't matter if you believe that the numbers are false. Like, all the conspiracy theories that we're yelling about right now are insignificant to this conversation, because whatever the reality is that we're living in, it's a reality that the NFL is going to have to deal with. So it doesn't matter how we got there. We're there. I don't understand how any of this really mitigates risk. They can test and they can try and make sure that people that get it don't spread it. But at this point, there's just no way to know what the impact is going to be by having people travel all over the country and play football. Like, we don't know is the only real answer.
No, everything you just described is risk mitigation, though. You said we can't mitigate risk, and then you described a number of things that mitigate risk.
Well, I know that's mitigating risk of the spread within your locker room, but
yes,
that's not mitigating risk of each person getting it, as long as they're living in a free world where they can go out and go to the club at night if they want to.
That's what the testing policies are for. That's what the person accountability part of this is. You can only put so much in place. When you're saying mitigate risk, we can't mitigate all of it. You control what you can control, the same way you prehab to try and make sure that you don't blow your knee out, the same way that I go in and do shoulder exercises so that I hopefully am strong enough around there to not tear my rotator cuff. I can still go out there and get my hand locked in a D lineman's pads and tear the hell out of my shoulder, but it doesn't mean I didn't try to stop it beforehand. That's all you're asking everyone to do in their individual circumstances. That's why Major League Baseball is an interesting comp. Because, yeah, we don't know about the travel portion of it yet, but the parts that they can control leading up to it right now, Buster Olmstead, others have said, they seem to have controlled really well, and people seem to be pleasantly surprised with the plan that they've had coming back, because that's all you can do. And then, like everyone else, like we talked about with the WNBA, you had a plan to get down to the bubble, and when people got there, they didn't like the way it looked. And so what happened? Kathy Engelbert, the WNBA's commissioner, started rolling up her sleeves and said, all right, let's start fixing this stuff as we go. You're going to have to patch some holes in the side of the ship if you want this thing to keep going and all that. That's what risk mitigation is. It's put a good plan in place, and then, man, be ready and flexible enough to start addressing the problems, not if, but when they start showing up.
But would you not agree that the risk has been mitigated far better by the NBA, WNBA, MLS, by being in a bubble?
Obviously. Like, so, day one stuff is they're going to be able to do that. A bubble is the best option in all this. The NFL is not going to be able. There is no realistic format where a bubble is humanly possible with the NFL. And so we leave that behind and say, yes, you're automatically more at risk than the NBA and MLS. I don't think anyone is unwilling to concede that.
So that's where I don't understand why we're not connecting the dots. They're trying to limit the roster sizes for the NFL coming into camp so that they limit the number of people that can come into the facility. But on game day, they're going to need bigger rosters, because what are you going to do when Saturday night somebody tests positive? Those two things don't match. And then you've got Buster Olney saying on this show an hour ago, he sees a 0% chance that the Major League Baseball season completes because it's going to go into the fall and they won't be able to handle it. That's the same issue the NFL is going to be dealing with. So to me, it's easy to connect the dots and say, well, Buster says 0% chance of baseball. That means 0% chance of football. They're dealing with the same variables.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I don't think they're going to finish a season. Like, that doesn't change the fact that they can only do the best that they can in all this if they're going to do it. Like, that sort of like nihilistic view of the way things are going to go shouldn't stop the people that are trying to do this from trying to do the thing if everyone agrees on it, because this is professional sports where both sides have a voice in all this. Like, we're getting ready to talk to Heather Dinich about a markedly different situation in the world of college athletics where all of this goes out the window because the dynamic is not the same, where in this one you've got well-paid adults who are allowed to have an input into the ultimate outcome of the decision. J.C. Treader represents the players. That Players Association represents the group so that they have an active choice in the outcome with what happens with their bodies coming up, which is different than what we're going to see at the college level. Golic and Wingo reminding you that 30 for 30 podcasts are back with Season 8. Heavy metals inside the Caroli Gymnastics Empire. I got it right today, and I'm very proud of myself. It's a groundbreaking 7-part podcast series that takes listeners on a deep dive into the lines of Bella and Marta Caroli, the most successful and controversial coaches in USA Gymnastics history. Listen to the trailer. Subscribe now to the 30 for 30 feed on Apple Podcasts. The whole season drops next Tuesday, July 14th, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. I practiced that all break, and I still almost ruined it. I made our producer, Allie, who has her background in gymnastics, very, very disappointed with my entire approach to all of this, but we somehow got through it. Thankfully, Heather's here to save us.
I was proud of you. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN News. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike, sitting with Mike Golic. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. Let's hop over to the Shell Penzo Performance Line, where we're joined by ESPN college football reporter Heather Dinich. Heather, we've had a lot of conversation this morning about, obviously, COVID-19 and what it means moving forward for everybody. We know at this point the Ivy League has the word was canceled around football, so the expectation is no college football season for the Ivy League. What was your reaction to that decision last night?
Well, I thought it was important to remember the reason they made that decision, which was campus policies. And that being some stringent policies that Robin Harris, the Ivy League executive director, made it impractical to have fall competition. She mentioned travel restrictions where they're coaches and student athletes can't go anywhere. There's also restrictions on visitors. There are stringent social distancing measures, and there's capacity limits for crowds of 25 to 50 people. So it's just impossible, literally, to have fall competition under those restrictions. That being said, every single university president throughout the country is probably paying attention to what the president at Harvard has to say about all of this. So while the Power Five commissioners hold the bulk of the power when it comes to decision-making process in college football, university presidents are key in all of this as to whether the season will happen at all and whether it will start on time.
So this is the first Division I conference to make this decision. But Heather, I'm curious, whether it's this or what we're seeing from Stanford, them cutting 11 varsity athletics programs after the 2020-2021 season, which of those, based on the reaction that you've heard, is the one that might be more concerning to other Power Five schools looking at these situations?
Well, I would think it would be the Ivy League situation, because the Power Five conferences and everybody in the FBS, they might all ultimately reach that same conclusion just through their own paths, right? Stanford is unique because to start, it had an above average amount of sports. That's important to remember. So when you're talking about testing every single athlete in every sport that you have, Shane Lyons at West Virginia told me it's roughly estimated to be between $20,000 and $25,000. Okay, so are you really going to want to? And no offense to the fencing program, but those are the ones that are on the line in terms of the budget cuts. And this isn't unique to Stanford. We're going to see more sports cut throughout the country. We're also seeing athletic departments at the highest level take pay cuts. Oklahoma just recently had its staff take 10% pay cuts for those who are making over $1 million, which was 6 people on that staff. So I do think that the Ivy League announcement will resonate, but I also do believe that there are going to be more athletic departments that have to cut their sports.
We're talking to ESPN college football reporter Heather Dinich. And Heather, I mean, maybe as a flaw, I focus too much on precedent. So what I keep seeing with the Ivy League is a precedent now where some very intelligent schools have looked at it and said it's not worth the risk. How concerned are other schools across the country about future liability legally when you've got a group of schools that have decided that they're not taking the risk, but other schools may decide to take that risk?
Sure. And again, that goes back to the university presidents. But liability is an important factor in all of this. You know, I talked with Robert Morris president Chris Howard. He was one of the college football playoff selection committees about that. And he said, look, we are doing everything we can and then some to follow CDC guidelines. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to protect us if kids are coming here and getting sick. So that's something university presidents everywhere are watching. And then if you want to take it a step further, what happens if there's a college football player with a pro career multi-million dollar chance at a future who contracts this virus? Then what do you do? And how does that play into the factor? So liability is certainly an issue at the highest level.
Heather, I'm curious. We heard from SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey last night addressing the topic of a spring season and not dismissing it, addressing it as if it was one of the options on the table. We had heard that months ago, but to hear it this close to the season, is that starting to be something that is gaining more traction as a realistic option in this, or still a worst-case scenario?
I don't believe it's gaining any more traction. Everybody that I've spoken with, from conference commissioners to athletic directors, has said, look, it's not our first option. It's not our second option. It's certainly doable, but there are so many problems with it that would have to be ironed out. I mean, I talked about the NFL draft, a concern there with the overlap, plus the possibility that big name players wouldn't play because of that. And then if you do have a spring season that's March, April, May, you're talking about training in January, February. And the reality of the situation is people are saying to me, look, we don't know that it's going to be any better then than it is now. So there are a lot of concerns with that, but they are saying at some point we might have to dust it off.
Talking to ESPN college football reporter Heather Dinich. Greg Sankey, again, as Mike alluded to, saying that the Ivy League's decision doesn't really impact their decision. What does, and when will they make it?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
What does impact their decision the most, and when do they expect to make a decision?
The most critical factors here are, one, are universities open? American Athletic Conference, Commissioner Mike Oresko told me, look, if students aren't on campus, all bets are off when it comes to college sports, right? But also, it's the coronavirus. That's the top decision maker. When you look at where the hot spots are, you can't throw a dart right now without hitting a Power 5 conference school. You're talking about California, Texas, Florida. All of those commissioners in those leagues are paying close attention to the numbers. And I can guarantee you, based on my conversation, there is much more pessimism around that than there was a couple of weeks ago. But the other thing that they're watching, guys, is what are our student athletes doing? They're on campus now for voluntary workouts, and they have gone to extreme lengths to protect them while they're in the athletic facilities. Everybody knew there was going to be positive tests, and then the question turns to what are they doing when they are away from the athletic facilities for whatever 22 hours it might be that they're not there. And athletic directors and commissioners are pleading, begging student athletes, wear a mask, social distance. Please take whatever precautions you can to protect yourself from this virus and the rest of your teammates. And that's why at Ohio State, you see things like the Buckeye Pledge that have surfaced, because Gene Smith there wants them to promise that they will do those things when they're not in the athletic facilities.
And, well, Heather, to that point, Ohio State just announced that they're going to be shutting down their athletics program, their athletic workouts on campus for the next week. North Carolina had 37 positive tests and is doing the same thing. So are a lot of them looking, and this is coming off 4th of July weekend that a lot of people around college football thought would be a big test. Is this a failure of that test in the minds of a lot of people looking at this situation?
Well, you know, I mean, this is the thing, guys. They are college students. You know, somebody put this in a great perspective the other day when talking about just what a hot spot Austin is right now. And students aren't even on campus there, 50,000 students, right? It's in trouble without university students there. So, you know, I think in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter if the kids are going to their favorite bar or the taco bar. They have to figure out how to protect themselves. And I'll tell you, the two schools I know right now that I think are doing an excellent job of this, based on my conversation, are Navy, because you're talking about the military, that has actual capability to lock them down. It's called ROM, the ROM, restriction of movement. They are in the yard, they're getting tested, and they're not going to downtown Annapolis into the bars. So that's good for them. Notre Dame, which happens to be Navy's first opponent of the season and a very big game if it actually happens, has their athletes in a hotel, and they're doing the best that they can to entertain them there, keep them there, and create that sort of bubble you guys were talking about within Notre Dame athletics. So I'm talking to Jack Swarbrick later today. We'll see how that's working out for them. But there's only so much you can do to contain student athletes. And we're not even in that period where we're actually hitting preseason workouts yet. That's the key window in my mind.
Heather, we appreciate your time and your expertise. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Stay safe, my friend. It's great stuff from Heather Dinich, obviously, as she breaks it down better than anybody. Just the facts, just the information that's there for us.
She did mention Notre Dame announced this. So this is 2 days ago, so it's somewhat dated as we know how fast this all moves. Notre Dame overall has administered, I believe the number is, Notre Dame overall has administered 252 COVID-19 tests to members of the football program and athletics departments with one positive test right now. So it is done. They've done a lot in containing the recovery, but also, as Heather talked about, and this was what Lincoln Riley brought up at the beginning of all this, the difficulty of once they're back in our charge on campus, it becomes our responsibility in the way that we have to handle and maneuver around all this stuff. People have said it's going to be the safest place, and that might be true, but it means that when they're testing positive and when the unsafe things happen, it falls on you and it weighs on the heads of all the decision makers in the process.
Well, all of this conversation came because the Ivy League made their decision yesterday to cancel fall sports. Coming up next, we'll talk to their executive director and find out what went into that decision. That's next, but first. All eyes yesterday were on the Ivy League and what they were going to decide to do with fall sports. We now know that answer, that there's been at the very least a postponement and a cancellation of football. So the question is, how did they get there? What factored into the decision and what's it mean? Go look and we go on ESPN Radio, ESPN News, presented by Progressive Insurance. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike, sitting with Mike Golic Jr. And, Mike, when I look across the board at this, I think all eyes were on the Ivy League yesterday and will continue to be on the Ivy League as they figure out what's right for them, and we try and figure out what that means for the rest of college football.
Exactly, and so as that first major decision was made, we're delighted to be joined by the Ivy League Executive Director, Robin Harris, with us. Robin, we really appreciate the time. Obviously, you guys have been in the focal point of a lot of news in the sports world, so I'm curious. I'm sure this wasn't a decision you came to lightly. What was really the last thing that took this over the line where you looked at this situation and said, we can't go forward this fall?
Yeah, you're exactly right. This was not a decision made lightly, and it was one that was made actually very carefully. And it was the product of months of conversation among the Ivy League presidents about how their campuses are adjusting to the continued spread of the COVID-19 disease and how to properly and safely administer the campuses in the fall. And so as devastated as we are for our student athletes and our coaches, it became apparent as campus policies for students generally and for the campuses were finalized in the past several weeks that it was not going to be possible to have athletic competition this fall because the policies across the campuses, and they vary from campus to campus, but generally speaking, there are travel restrictions for faculty, staff, and students. There's limits on who can visit campuses, who can enter campus buildings. There are social distancing requirements, limits on the sizes of groups that can gather. Several of our campus right now have limits of 25 as the size of groups. And then we have a number of campuses who have significantly limited the number of students who are able to come back and be in residence on campus due to dormitory limitations and social distancing needs. So when you take all of that together, we treat our student athletes are students. Campus policies apply to intercollegiate athletics, and it became readily apparent that it was not feasible to be able, that we weren't going to be able to hold athletic competition this fall. And it's a sad decision. It's one we didn't want to have to make, but it was very clear it was the right decision.
We're speaking with Ivy League Executive Director Robin Harris on Golic and Wingo, Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike. So, Robin, how much consideration was given for football to moving it to the spring?
So no decision has been made on that yet. So that is an option that still exists for football as well as for the other fall sports. The presidents specifically indicated that there would be no competition at least through the end of the fall semester. And it is premature to make any decisions about winter or spring competition.
And with that in mind, January 1st was set at the date that no decision would be made before then. So as you continue to evaluate, are there certain markers that you guys will be looking for in order to decide, all right, it is safe to resume play in any of the sports, let alone the logistics of moving what we've had in the fall to later in the spring?
So a very minor point, we have not specified any date. One of the early stories that came out that was premature was prior to our release. It had a January 1st date in it, and I don't know where that came from because we have no date specified. What we have said is there'll be no athletic competition through the fall semester. And fall semester then sometime in December. And sometime during, prior to that time, we'll have to make a decision about winter sports. And then at another time about spring sports. And frankly, you know, the situation with the virus has to change for us to be able to have competition. And we certainly hope that it does. And we hope that we are able to contain the virus. We hope that our medical community is able to better treat the virus, particularly for those who get very sick and who, unfortunately, you know, we have the death rate is too high. And maybe at some point there will be a vaccine as well. But generally we have to have better health and safety outcomes so that our campus policies change. And when that happens, then we would love to be able to have competition.
We're speaking to Ivy League Executive Director Robin Harris. Robin, would you then be comfortable having sports be played before a vaccine is out?
You know, I think it's going to be looking at the totality of the circumstances and what our campus policies end up being and what the state regulations as well. And so we have to get to a situation where the risk and the health and safety picture is just so much better than what it exists today. And, you know, a vaccine, people keep pointing to that, and that is ultimately the goal, right, to make sure that we can really protect the health and safety of campus communities and the population at large. I don't know that that's necessarily the only way that there would be competition.
Robin, in that regard, you guys have a lot of differences in the structure of sports in the Ivy Leagues as opposed to what we see in other forms in the larger Power Five conferences. But with that being said, with you guys and all the thought that's gone into this decision-making, has there been any communication from some of the Power Five schools, other Division One presidents, you know, conferences with you in regards to how you guys got this decision?
So it hasn't been that long, but as commissioners, we have been meeting regularly by video call for several months now. We exchange information, and I think what's important here is we made a decision for the Ivy League. Our presidents made this decision based on Ivy League campus policies, and it's absolutely the right decision for the Ivy League, and different conferences and different schools are going to have to look at their own policies and their own considerations to decide how best to proceed.
Robin, were there particular people within the medical community that you guys leaned on to get information as you made these decisions?
Yeah, that's a good question because that came up a lot in March as well. So our presidents have each incredible resources that they rely on in setting their campus policies. We have obviously university hospitals, medical schools, epidemiologists, infectious disease specialists on our campuses, and our presidents tap into those individuals as well as other experts, whether they're alumni, governmental experts, and that informs the campus policies, and then as a result, that has a direct impact on our athletics policies. So, for example, our presidents have said that athletics activities can occur on campus for students, student-athletes who are enrolled this fall in a phased-in and safe manner and subject to campus policy. And what that means is our student-athletes and coaches will be able to have modified practice opportunities throughout the fall as they are deemed to be safe by the campuses.
And Robin, just to be clear, because you've brought up some notes in here about some of the reporting and clarifying some things for us, I just want to also be clear that you guys have stated relative to the contracts of the coaches involved in these situations, relative to, and really for me, the eligibility of the student athletes. Will there be a preservation of that year of eligibility for the student athletes affected by this in the fall?
Yeah, so for fall sport athletes in particular, because they will not be having competition this fall, they will not lose a season of eligibility, even if they practice.
Awesome. That's great to know. Just wanted to clarify that in the interest of making sure we've got all of this nailed down in a lot of this. Robin, thank you so much for all the information on this. Obviously, a difficult decision, as you said, but one you guys clearly put a ton of thought and time into. So thank you for the time, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you so much, and hopefully next time when I talk to you all, it can be about a much happier topic.
Absolutely. We are all hoping that. Amen to that. Indeed. Robin Harris, the Ivy League Executive Director.
I got to take a second and acknowledge, I really appreciate that she came on so transparently about their decision-making process. And this is a reminder, she stressed, they got to make the right decision for the Ivy League. And that's what every conference is going to have to do. The question is, what motivates that decision? School policy motivated that decision for the Ivy League. Easier to do, frankly, when you're talking about a lot less money, about $11 million each generated for the bigger schools in football on this versus the $150 million in Ohio State. So it'll be interesting because what you can tell when you talk to Robin, they put their policy first, and that's what they considered. I'll be interested to see if conferences that have a lot more at stake are able to sort of partition the cash out and not make that part of their decision-making process.
You would hope, because you look at this and you say, as we look at the morality of the situation, it's hard to really avoid seeing, all right, a place where the financials are not going to govern the decision decided that this was not a safe enough environment for this to take place in and responded accordingly.
Coming up, knuck if you buck and cake. That's right, because pie's still trash. We're going to do all that next.
Golic and Wingo's brought to you by Barbasol. Your high-pitched voice over the top of Knuck If You Buck is the worst remix in history.
You know what? The best thing is that you're going to hear it every time you hear this song from now on.
Not a chance. Golic and Wingo's brought to you by Barbasol. Barbasol shaving cream is available in five fantastic flavors to customize your close shave. Whether it's the classic, original, or sensitive skin, there's one for every face. Find your favorite Barbasol today. Jason, Knuck If You Buck will only ever sound like the gnashing of teeth, the clanging of metal, the breaking of bones, and pure human sweat to me, because it is all of those things. It is chaos in motion. It is beauty. It is majesty. It's knucking and bucking and ready to fight.
Knuck If You Buck. Ha ha. It's Golic and Wingo on ESPN Radio. I'm just trying to make sure that Mike can't have anything nice. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike Golick, sitting with Mike Golick Jr. Obviously, Nuck If You Buck If You Missed earlier was a part of our conversation with L. Duncan. Go check it out in the podcast. We had a really good talk over there about several other things. But, Mike, I do want to ask you. We just finished having a serious conversation about the Ivy League and the future of college football for this fall. Today, where do you sit on your level of confidence that we will have college football in, you know, September?
It definitely took a hit, and I think it's the combination of things that we saw yesterday. It is certainly the Ivy League looking at the situation and saying, relative to what's going on our campuses, we don't feel comfortable proceeding with fall athletics. It's the announcement from Stanford, which, as Heather Dinich pointed out, it was a program that had a lot more, you know, more Division I varsity sports than most universities are carrying, announcing that they're going to be cutting 11 varsity athletics programs after the 2020-2021 season in all of this. It's the announcement that Ohio State was suspending activities on campus for athletics for the following week because of a rash of positive tests. North Carolina dealing with the same thing in all of this. And so we're seeing more and more signs that this situation might be untenable in the world of college athletics. And so I still think the money is going to dictate that something happens, but I think the spring season is going to become more and more of an option as people start to look at this. It sounds like the worst case scenario right now, but I think relative to the reality that's starting to happen in this country around all of these college campuses, because they're not immune to it as much as Jim Harbaugh might want to believe so, they're not immune to what's happening around the country. And I think ultimately that might drive us toward a spring season being more and more of an option here.
Spring season is hard for me to see. And it's hard for me to see because it backs up to where the NFL draft is and the number of players that will be impacted, plus the short turnaround to the next season. So there's a part of me that thinks that's difficult to see. That being said, it's far better than nothing. I wonder if we're going to end up split. I mean, genuinely, there's two ways I think this goes. One, we start a season and then it doesn't finish, or it finishes in the spring, which I think is a viable thing that could have to be looked at some point. Two, and I think this is more realistic in my mind, I think we're in a spot where there are going to be 20 or 30 or 40 schools that look across the board and say, hey, I don't care about the risk. I care about the money, and we're going to play college football no matter what. And, you know, you start to look at some of the areas, like I mentioned so often, having spent so much time in Nashville during COVID-19, during the quarantine, and you see how differently they handle it in Tennessee than they do in Connecticut. I'm left to wonder if there aren't a group of states that just say, forget it. I don't care. I'm going to go out and we're going to play college football. And you're going to end up with this group of, you know, there's no conferences. It's just a bunch of teams figuring out how to play against each other. It sounds like the Wild Wild West, but I think that's viable.
I just think that because of what we saw in the spring, which is if there are big time D1 Power 5 schools that start to bow out, the pressure it starts to put on the other ones, despite the financial ramifications there, to be the school that's not shutting down, to be the conference that's not shutting down. People accuse the Ivies of being premature in the spring, and then everyone ended up following suit. And you had Duke and teams in the ACC telling the NCAA tournament, we're not showing up to the party, and putting pressure on everybody else to say, all right, well, they toppled like the NCAA tournament. March Madness got toppled because some of those things started to pile up too much. So that's what I worry about with your plan.
I agree with you. The thing is, it took Duke and Kentucky. I think if the Ivy League had said we're out, we still would have had a tournament. When Duke and Kentucky, or it might have been Duke and Kansas, came in and said we're out, you're talking about two of the biggest brands. It would take Clemson and Bama doing that for that to happen. It would take, you know, major schools from the SEC and from the Big Ten deciding they don't want to play. I don't know that those markets will do that. Like, if the Pac-12 decides they're not going to play football, do we really think it'll shut down football for, you know, the SEC or for the Big Ten? I don't know.
No, I guess I'm saying it depends on who, though, in your scenario, right. If we're talking about all those schools and who's driven the most financially by some of these realities, because I get it. I get the fears of the spring season. I get the fear of losing great players to the draft. But relative to where we are right now and our desperation for all of this, if you lose some of the best players in college football but still ultimately get a product and potentially get it, because this is all betting on the idea of it would be safer then for any number of reasons, which could include a vaccine that could allow you to have crowds at stadiums at that point in all of this, that could allow you to get the games off in a way that's going to be less, you know, open to interruption, that could all give you a better chance at recouping the financials that you could lose in this situation. And even if it misses out on some of the truly best players in all this, you still have a college football product that people would be willing to consume.
And that's a fair point, especially considering we have to remember that the great players that wouldn't be playing are spread across the board. I mean, all teams would be dealing with the same disadvantage at that point, that they'd be losing their most draft-eligible prospects from their roster. So there would be equity and parity in that process.
Exactly. Golic and Wingo here on ESPN Radio. One of the things that we talked about this morning, in addition to all the college football conversation, Field Yates brought this up. Store-bought cake and its beauty, and we both love it. Field loves it and all this. People brought this up idea. Are there things that you're not allowed to get from the grocery store? Because we had people telling us you can't get flowers at the grocery store. You can't get cake at the grocery store. They treated those like, and someone said, sushi you can't get at the grocery store. Is there any no-no for you when it comes to what you can get from like a grocery store food area?
Oh, heck no. A, I get grocery store sushi, and at some places it's pretty good. I love grocery store cake. And when I'm putting flowers in the house, I go to the grocery store. They're cheaper.
What about when you're giving flowers to your wife?
Well, I mean, When I'm putting them in the house,
see,
I
that's,
go to the grocery store.
Man, that is an uncomfortable bit of reality in that stammer right there. Sonny, Jason's wife, if you're listening right now, just know your man's been had.
I mean, in the house. What about your girlfriend, Mike?
That's political.
Oh, my God.
You go to hell, Jason Fitz. Turn knuck if you buck on and let me get after Jason Fitz here in this basement.
Oh, coming up on Friday, I might be dead. We'll see. Lane Johnson, all the times we messed up reading this week. Dr. Myron Roll, that's all tomorrow.